This CLE is based on summaries of New York State appellate decisions released in May of 2020 dealing with civil procedure related issues. Those summaries have been compiled in the May 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet that constitutes the written materials for this course, and the page references are to the pamphlet. The first case is on page 4, Reed versus New York State Electric and Gas Corporation. Deals with the appealability of motions in limine, and there's also a statute of limitations issue. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held 1. Plaintiff did not allege separate claims for personal injury and wrongful death. Therefore, the 2-year wrongful death statute of limitations in the Estates, Powers, and Trust Law, Section 5-4.1, not the 1-year 90-day statute of limitations for negligence, applied to the actions against the municipalities. So again, the complaint did not have a separate claim for personal injury. It was a single claim for wrongful death, and therefore the 2-year statute applied. Next issue addressed by the court, motions in limine, which limit the scope of the trial, are appealable. And finally, the preclusion of plaintiff's expert's testimony based upon deficient disclosure pursuant to CPLR 3101 was deemed an abuse of discretion. The action arose from a gas explosion at the great-grandfather's house, which killed plaintiff's 15-month-old son. Plaintiff sued the village, the town, the county, and the New York State Electric and Gas Corporation. With respect to the motions in limine, the Third Department wrote, an order ruling on a motion in limine is generally not appealable as of right or by permission, since an order made in advance of trial, which merely determined the admissibility of evidence, is an unappealable advisory ruling. However, an order that limits the scope of issues to be tried, affecting the merits of the controversy, or the substantial rights of a party, is appealable. As to plaintiff's objection to that part of the order as allowed evidence of the great-grandfather's negligence as a defense to the claim of res ipsa loquitur, does not limit the scope of issues or impact a substantial right, and therefore is not appealable. Plaintiff also contends Supreme Court erred in partially granting New York State Electric and Gas's motion to preclude the testimony of an expert named Reiber, an economist. Finding that the expert disclosure lacked reasonable detail as to how the value that Reiber assigned to plaintiff's lost services and support would be calculated, Supreme Court precluded his testimony with regard to those damages. However, because this ruling restricted plaintiff's ability to prove and recover damages, this issue is appealable. Next is Pariah versus Meisenberg on page 5. It's a medical malpractice case which raised the issue of the effect of not listing the malpractice action as an asset in a bankruptcy proceeding. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant's motion to dismiss the medical malpractice complaint on judicial estoppel grounds should not have been granted. The injured party name was Vorm Nadirian. That's the party that also filed for bankruptcy. Vorm Nadirian commenced a medical malpractice action in 2006. In 2 bankruptcy proceedings in 2008 and 2016, the medical malpractice action was not listed as an asset. In 2017, Vorm Nadirian opened the 2008 bankruptcy action, and the medical malpractice action was added as an asset, making the bankruptcy trustee the plaintiff in that action. The Second Department held Vorm Nadirian's initial failure to list the malpractice action as an asset did not subject the bankruptcy trustee as the plaintiff in the malpractice action to the judicial estoppel doctrine. In other words, the lawsuit could go ahead despite it not being listed initially. The court wrote, the integrity of the bankruptcy system depends on full and honest disclosure by debtors of all their assets. By failing to list causes of action on bankruptcy schedules of assets, the debtor represents that it has no such claims. Thus, the doctrine of judicial estoppel may bar a party from pursuing claims which were not listed in a previous bankruptcy proceeding. Because the doctrine is primarily concerned with protecting the judicial process, relief is granted only when the risk of inconsistent results with its impact on judicial integrity is certain. Here, the 2008 bankruptcy proceeding was reopened by the bankruptcy court, so the 2006 medical malpractice action could be identified as an asset of the bankruptcy estate. Therefore, judicial estoppel cannot be predicated on Vorm Nadirian's failure to list the action as an asset when she originally filed the 2008 bankruptcy petition. Further, once a bankruptcy proceeding is commenced, all legal or equitable interests of the debtor become part of the bankruptcy estate, including any causes of action, citing 11 U.S.C. Section 541. The trustee in bankruptcy, as representative of the estate, has capacity to sue and be sued. So by having the bankruptcy court reopen the 2008 bankruptcy and adding the medical malpractice action as an asset in that proceeding, the trustee became the plaintiff, and the trustee was not judicially estopped from bringing that lawsuit. Next is Rivera on page 6. It just deals with a misnomer, naming the party in error on a complaint. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, determined the misdescription in the summons and complaint did not prejudice the city, which had notice of plaintiff's suit, the court wrote. The summons and complaint were served on Corporation Counsel for the City of New York, which answered on behalf of the City of New York. Defendant's motion to dismiss the complaint should have been denied, and plaintiff's cross motion to amend the summons and complaint to correct the misnomer should have been granted. The city was not prejudiced by the misdescription and was on notice that plaintiff intended to seek a judgment against it. And the defendant in that lawsuit was the New York City Department of Sanitation. It's not clear, but that was probably not named correctly in the initial complaint. Next is matter of Dao Yin versus Cuomo on page 6. It deals with an executive order issued in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Second Department, converting the Article 78 proceeding to a declaratory judgment action, held the executive order canceling the June 2020 special election for Queensborough president was a valid exercise of the governor's authority in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The court wrote, the governor demonstrated that the canceling of the special election, which would have been held pursuant to the New York City Charter, Section 81, was the minimum deviation necessary to assist or aid in coping with the COVID-19 pandemic, and was authorized pursuant to the emergency powers granted to the governor by Executive Law Section 29-A. Next on page 7 is matter of Periscondo versus Monheit. It's another COVID-19 related executive order. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the witnessing of petition signatures need not be done prior to the deadline for gathering the signatures. The court wrote, these are unusual times occasioned by the onset of the COVID-19 virus. The state has undertaken various measures to protect the health and safety of its residents by limiting the face-to-face contact of persons and thereby minimizing the extent of human transmission of the virus. Some of the state's measures are set forth in executive orders of the governor, including, as relevant here, Executive Order Number 202.2, Executive Order Number 202.2, dated March 14, 2020, modified Article 6 of the election law to reduce the number of petition signatures required for placing candidates' names on ballots, and to suspend the gathering of signatures after 5 p.m. on March 17, 2020. The executive order is consistent with the state's policy of limiting social and professional interactions and community contact transmissions of COVID-19. The language of the executive order plainly directs that only the gathering of signatures was subject to the deadline of 5 p.m. on March 17. The signatures contained in the appellant's designating petition were all gathered prior to that deadline. The language of the executive order provides no truncated deadline for the witnessing of those signatures. Indeed, since the witnessing of signatures is a ministerial task unrelated to the face-to-face interactions that Executive Order No. 202.2 was issued to minimize, there would be no reason for the governor to have intended, or for the executive order itself to provide, that the witnessing of signatures also be suspended as of 5 p.m. on March 17, 2020. Thus, we disagree with the Supreme Court's determination granting the petition to invalidate the appellant's designating petition on the ground that the executions of the statement of witness on March 19, 2020 violated the signature gathering deadline of Executive Order No. 202.2. Next, on page 8, is Laundry Palace versus Nassau County. It deals with the appropriate disposition of a declaratory judgment action prior to an answer being served. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, explained that an action for a declaratory judgment should not be dismissed at the pre-answer stage when the pleading standards are met. The court wrote, "The plaintiffs alleged that certain provisions of Nassau County Administrative Code dealing with dry cleaners and laundromats were unconstitutional, unconstitutionally vague, served no legitimate purpose, and lacked any substantial relationship to the legislative intent. A motion to dismiss a declaratory judgment prior to the service of an answer presents for consideration only the issue of whether a cause of action for declaratory relief is set forth, not the question of whether the plaintiff is entitled to a favorable disposition. Where a cause of action is sufficient to invoke the court's power to render a declaratory judgment as to the rights and other legal relations of the parties to a justiciable controversy, a motion to dismiss that cause of action should be denied." Here, the complaint was sufficient to invoke the court's power to render a declaratory judgment as to the rights and other legal relations of the parties to a justiciable controversy, citing CPLR 3001. A complaint will not be dismissed pursuant to CPLR 3211 merely because the plaintiffs may not be entitled to a declaration in their favor, ultimately. So again, at the pre-answer stage, a court looking at a complaint seeking a declaratory judgment can only look at the sufficiency of the complaint and not deal with the merits. Next is the Elder Co. case on pages 8 and 9, Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to vacate a default judgment should not have been granted because the excuse was not reasonable. The court wrote, "A defendant seeking to vacate a default in answering a complaint must show both a reasonable excuse for the default and the existence of a potentially meritorious defense," citing CPLR 5015. Here, the defendant's proffered excuse that its president failed to open and review the contents of a package following its personal delivery upon him, and that the summons and verified complaint may inadvertently have been discarded thereafter, were insufficient to demonstrate a reasonable excuse for the default. Next is the Kauai case on page 9. It's another case dealing with a default judgment. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant Swanston's motion to vacate the default judgment should not have been granted. The excuse was not deemed reasonable, and therefore the merits of the case need not be considered. Court wrote, "The motion court thought that Swanston's excuses might not be valid, but that they were plausible. However, plausibility is not the standard. Rather, on a CPLR 5015 motion, the movement must show a reasonable excuse for his default. Swanston's one-sided understanding that plaintiffs would refrain from prosecuting their lawsuit while defendant negotiated to sell itself did not constitute a reasonable excuse for failing to answer. Given the absence of a reasonable excuse, we need not determine whether a meritorious defense exists. Next is preferred mutual insurance on page 10. It briefly mentions an issue related to e-filing. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for a default judgment should have been denied, and defendant's cross motion to renew should have been granted. The court noted that Chenango County is a consensual or voluntary e-filing county, and defendant's hard copy filing should not have been rejected by the court for failure to e-file. The court wrote, Supreme Court abused its discretion in granting plaintiff's motion for a default judgment. Although defendant's motion papers lacked specific details of the underlying circumstances for the delay here was de minimis, 1 week, and should be excused. Defendant timely opposed the motion, offering a meritorious defense. There's no indication that the default was willful or that plaintiff was prejudiced as a result of the late answer. Moreover, defendant appeared in the action when he opposed plaintiff's motion for a preliminary injunction and temporary restraining order. Public policy favors the resolution of cases on the merits. Supreme Court confused the cross motion to renew with a motion to reargue and summarily denied it since it was not made within 30 days. That time period applies solely to motions to reargue. And again, the e-filing issue here was because Chenango County is a consensual or voluntary e-filing county. A motion should not be rejected in that county based on the fact that it was filed as a hard copy. Next is the Zhig case, Z-H-I-G-U-E, on page 11. And it has to do with actions taken sua sponte by the judge. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte searched the record to grant relief that was not requested in this Labor Law 240 Subdivision 1 and 241 Subdivision 6 negligence action. Plaintiff was injured when a portion of a ceiling fell, causing a scaffold to collapse on him. The judge should not have granted summary judgment on a negligence cause of action, which was not included in the motions, and should not have granted summary judgment on a res ipsa loquitur theory. The court wrote, while it is well settled that Supreme Court has the authority to search the record and grant summary judgment to a non-moving party with respect to an issue that was the subject of the motion before the court, citing CPLR 3212, here the court in effect searched the record and awarded summary judgment to the movant with respect to an issue that was not the subject of the motion before the court. Next is a matter of Hodge on page 12. It's a family court case dealing with a jurisdiction over a custody proceeding. The Second Department held family court should not have dismissed mother's petition seeking sole custody of the children who lived out of state without first making a ruling on whether it had continuing jurisdiction over custody matters. The court wrote, on November 22, 2016, the family court issued an order, hereinafter the custody order, awarding joint legal custody of the subject children to the mother and to the children's godmother, with primary physical custody and final decision-making authority to the godmother. Pursuant to the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act, codified in Article 5-A of the Domestic Relations Law, a court in this state which has made an initial custody determination has exclusive continuing jurisdiction over that determination until it finds that it should relinquish jurisdiction because the child does not have a significant connection with New York and substantial evidence is no longer available in this state concerning the child's care, protection, training, and personal relationships. Family court should not have summarily dismissed the mother's petition on the ground that your children had been living with the godmother in Pennsylvania, without considering whether it had exclusive continuing jurisdiction pursuant to Domestic Relations Law Section 76-A, and affording the mother an opportunity to present evidence as to that issue. Next is Highland Crusader Offshore Partners. It's on page 13. It's another jurisdiction case, this time dealing with a forum selection clause. The First Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Manzanet Daniels, determined that defendants' close relationship with signatories to contracts with forum selection clauses justified the exercise of jurisdiction for purposes of jurisdictional discovery. The court wrote, a non-signatory may be bound by a forum selection clause where the non-signatory and a party to the agreement have such a close relationship that it's foreseeable that the forum selection clause will be enforced against the non-signatory. The rationale for binding non-signatories is based on the notion that forum selection clauses promote stable and dependable trade relations, and therefore that it would be contrary to public policy to allow non-signatory entities through which a party acts to evade the forum selection clause. The motion court did not undertake a separate minimum contacts analysis. However, the concept of foreseeability is built into the closely related doctrine, which explicitly requires that the relationship between the parties be such that it is foreseeable that the non-signatory will be bound by the forum selection clause. The courts have recognized that a consent to jurisdiction by virtue of the close relationship between the non-signatory and contracting party, obviating the need for a separate analysis of constitutional propriety. Next is Lisa I. on page 14. It raised an issue that hasn't been dealt with at the appellate level, and the Third Department here also avoided dealing with it, whether the rape shield law can be applied in a civil case. The Third Department upheld Supreme Court's protective order prohibiting plaintiff's child from being questioned about her sexual history. The complaint alleged the child was raped during a sleepover at defendant's home. The complaint alleged several theories of liability, including negligent supervision. Supreme Court held that the rape shield law applied to the civil case. The Third Department held it did not need to reach that issue, holding that the court had the authority to prohibit the testimony to protect the child from embarrassment. The court wrote, Supreme Court was required to balance plaintiff's concern that the child's sexual history is irrelevant and that questions of this nature are nothing more than a form of intimidation and embarrassment against defendant's argument that the child had a motive to fabricate the allegations of assault because of a purported pregnancy. The record reveals Supreme Court undertook a balancing of these concerns. We find that plaintiff met her burden of showing annoyance and embarrassment. The child's sexual history, sexual conduct, and pregnancies are not relevant or material to the elements of the causes of action for negligence, battery, intentional infliction of emotional distress, or loss of services. Moreover, it has been determined that there is a limited value to testimony concerning the sexual past of a victim of sexual assault. Instead, it often serves only to harass the victim and confuse the jurors. Next is D'Amato on page 15. It's a motion to set aside the verdict, which the appellate court ruled should have been granted because the court was misled about the relationship between a witness and a party. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to set aside the jury verdict in this personal injury case should have been granted. One of the issues in the trial was the identity of the party which left a pipe in a tunnel. Plaintiff alleged he was injured when he tripped over the pipe. Defendants presented a witness named Dudin, D-U-D-I-N, who testified that defendants were not responsible for leaving the pipe in the tunnel. Dudin was represented as a disinterested witness when, in fact, he was employed by the defendants. The court wrote, the record reveals that the defendants affirmatively represented to the jury that Dudin was a disinterested objective witness, notwithstanding that he was employed by the defendants at the time of trial. During summation, the defendant's counsel stated that Duden was with the construction manager and that he was not on the defendant's payroll, but rather was a representative of the Department of Environmental Protection. Additionally, the defendant's counsel stated that you heard from Mr. Duden, who is with the Department of Environmental Protection now. This is not the defendant's stuff in the tunnel. Counsel specifically referred to Duden as an objective witness who has no dealings with the defendants and stated that he was there to help the injured plaintiff. Under the circumstances, we find that the jury should have had the opportunity to consider Duden's status as an employee of the defendants in assessing his credibility and in determining whether this relationship biased or influenced the witness's testimony. Next is the U.S. Bank case on page 16. It's a foreclosure case dealing with the statute of limitations, and it concerns the issue of whether the mortgage debt was accelerated by a voluntary discontinuance of the prior foreclosure. Third Department, reversing Supreme Court over a two-justice dissent, held the foreclosure action was time-barred. The initial foreclosure was started in 2010. That action was discontinued and the mortgage was subsequently assigned three times. After a second discontinuance, the third foreclosure action was commenced in 2017. The majority concluded that the discontinuances and related correspondence did not deaccelerate the debt, so the statute of limitations kept running from the initial action in 2010. The dissenters argued the debt had been deaccelerated by correspondence with the defendant. The court wrote, "The voluntary discontinuance of the first two actions without more did not constitute an affirmative revocation of the initial acceleration of the debt. This is particularly so because plaintiff's predecessors in interest moved to discontinue each action due to title concerns, without addressing the prospect of revoking the acceleration and resuming installment payments. The plaintiff's letters do not indicate a clear and unambiguous return to an installment payment plan, and for all practical purposes, do not actually evidence any real intent to deaccelerate the loan. In effect, plaintiffs simply put defendants on notice of its obligation to cure a default and then promptly embarked on the notices required to initiate a third foreclosure action. In our view, these notices do not constitute affirmative actions to deaccelerate the debt." So again, because the debt was not deaccelerated by the motions to discontinue or the voluntary discontinuances, the statute of limitations kept running and it ran out. Next is Herrera versus Vargas on page 17. It's a slip and fall case, and it has a slip and fall issue, and it's also a case that has something to say about what can be alleged in response to a summary judgment motion. First Department, reversing Supreme Court in this sidewalk slip and fall case, held one, a 2019 Court of Appeals decision clarified that the defendant out of possession landlord had a duty to keep the sidewalk safe, notwithstanding any maintenance agreement with the tenant. Two, although the plaintiff was required to allege the defendant violated the New York City Administrative Code and failed to do so, plaintiff could rely on that code provision in opposition to defendant's summary judgment motion. The court wrote, the court's determination that defendant was entitled to summary judgment dismissing the complaint on the ground that he is an out-of-possession landlord is no longer sound in light of the Court of Appeals decision in Zhang Fu He versus Troon Management, 34 New York 3rd, 167. Even if plaintiff was required to plead defendant's violation of administrative code of the City of New York, which he undisputedly failed to do, plaintiff's reliance on that for the first time in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment was permissible, given that doing so did not raise any new theory of liability or prejudice. At this point, I'm going to insert the code, the verification code, to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this May 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The code to be placed on the attorney affirmation is estoppel. Again, the code word to be placed on the attorney affirmation is estoppel. Next is the PH 105 case, page 18. It deals with the concept of tax estoppel. First Department, reversing Supreme Court and clarifying a prior ruling, held that the doctrine of tax estoppel applied to preclude defendant, whose name was Elian, from taking a position contrary to the factual statements in corporate tax returns with respect to an ownership interest in the corporation Edgewater. The court wrote, the court improvidently exercised its discretion in failing to apply the doctrine of tax estoppel. Under that doctrine, defendants' acts in filing corporate tax returns for the years 2010 through 2014, signed by defendant Elian, which contained factual statements that plaintiff Jabber had a 75% ownership interest in Edgewater during that time period, and precludes defendants from taking a position contrary to that in this litigation. Then it went on to say, to the extent our decision in matter of Banji versus Baluch, 99 AD 3rd, 587, has been interpreted as making the doctrine generally inapplicable with respect to factual statements of ownership and tax returns, we clarify the doctrine applies whereas here, the party seeking to contradict the factual statements as to ownership in the tax returns signed the tax returns and has failed to assert any basis for not crediting the statements. In the final case, in this May 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE, is on pages 18 and 19, NYCTL 1997-1 Trust. It deals with the effect of a tax foreclosure on bringing a subsequent foreclosure action. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Shankman, held that HPD, the holder of a first mortgage on property which was the subject of a tax foreclosure, was entitled to the surplus funds from the tax foreclosure sale. The issue was whether HPD's action seeking the surplus was time-barred because it didn't enforce the lien on the surplus within 6 years of the tax foreclosure sale. The Second Department held no further action to enforce the lien was necessary because HPD was a defendant in the tax foreclosure proceedings. And the court said, HPD's appearance in the tax lien foreclosure action put the property owner and anyone else interested in a potential surplus on notice of HPD's claims. To require HPD to commence a separate foreclosure action when an action to foreclose the tax lien was already pending would serve no useful purpose. So the time, the statute of limitations did not run on the mortgage holder's lien on the surplus proceeds after a tax foreclosure sale. So that concludes this May 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.